Chapter 24. I have heard voices thick with sorrow. I have seen faces crumble with grief. I have beheld broken men rise to stand, and witnessed women walk from small graves. Yet now you would speak of weakness, of failings worth nothing but scorn. You would show all the sides of your fear, brazen as trophies in the empty shell of conquest. But what have you won when the night draws close to make stern your resolve among these shadows, when at last we are done with the world, when we neither stand nor fall nor wake from stillness, and the silent unknowing waits for us? I have heard my voice thick with sorrow. I have felt my face crumble with grief. I have broken and turned away from graves, and I have grasped tight this hand of weakness, and walked in the company of familiar failings. Scorn lies in the dust and in the distance behind. Every trophy fades from sight. The night lies ahead, drawing me into its close. For when I am done with this world, in the unknowing I will listen for the silence, to await what is to come. And should you seek more, find me in this place before the rising dawn. Journey's Resolution, Fisher Keltath. Banaskar remembered how she had stood, a sword in its scabbard lying on the map table before her. A single oil lamp had bled weak light and weaker shadows in the confines of the tent. The air was close and damp, and it settled on things like newborn skin. A short time earlier, she had spoken to Lostari Yil with her back to that weapon, and Banaskar did not know if Tavare had used those words before, and the question of that gnawed at him in strange, mysterious ways. If they had been words oft repeated by the adjunct, then what tragic truths did that reveal about her? But if she'd not said them before, not ever, then why had he heard them as if they were echoes, rebounding from some place far away and long ago? Lostara had been to see Hanavat, to share in the gift of the son that had been born. The captain's eyes had been red from weeping, and Banaskar understood the losses these women were now facing, the futures about to be torn away from them. He should not have been there. He should not have heard the adjunct speak. It is not enough to wish for a better world for the children. It is not enough to shield them with ease and comfort. Lostari Yil, if we do not sacrifice our own ease, our own comfort, to make the future's world a better one, then we curse our own children. We leave them a misery they do not deserve. We leave them a host of lessons unearned. I am no mother, but I need only look at Hanavat to find the strength I need. The words were seared into his memory. In the voice of a childless woman, they left him more shaken, more distraught than he perhaps would otherwise have been. Was this what they were fighting for? Only one among a host of reasons, surely. And in truth, he could not quite see how this path they'd chosen could serve such aspirations. He did not doubt the nobility of the adjunct's motivations, nor even the raw compassion so driving her to seek what was, in most eyes, virtually impossible. But there was something else here, something still hidden. How many great compassions arose from a dark source, a private place of secret failings? After she had sent Lostara away, Tavare had turned once more to the sword, and after a time Banaskar had stirred from his seat on the war gear chest, risen and walked to her side.
I have stopped running, adjunct.
She was silent, her eyes fixed on the weapon in its battered, scratched scabbard.
I wish to thank you for that. Proof, he added with a sour smile, of your gifts of achieving the impossible.
Priest, she said, the Chalmanaga, the snake, that was a manifestation of Derek, was it not? He found himself unable to meet her eyes, but managed a simple shrug.
I think so. For a time. Her children were lost, in her eyes anyway. And that made her just as lost, I suppose. Together, they needed to find their way.
Those details do not interest me, she said, tone hardening. Beniscar, tell me, what does she want? Why is she so determined to be here? Will she seek to oppose me?
Why would you think I have answers to those questions, adjunct?
Because she never left you either. She needed at least one of her worshippers to live on, and for some unknown reason she chose you. He wanted to sit down again, anywhere, maybe even on the floor.
Adjunct, it is said that a worm finding itself in a puddle of ale will get drunk and then drown. I've often thought about that, and I admit I've come to suspect that any puddle will do, and getting drunk has nothing to do with it. The damned things drown anyway. And yet, oddly enough, without any puddles, the worms don't show up at all.
We have left the new lake behind us, priest. No one drowned, not even you.
They're just children now.
I know. Beniscar sighed, nodded down at the sword.
She will protect it, adjunct.
He heard her breath catch, and then... But that might well kill her. He nodded, not trusting himself to speak. Are you certain of this, Demidrek?
Demi, gods below, adjunct. Are you a student of theology as well? Teishren was...
As the last surviving priest of the Worm of Autumn, the honorific belongs to you, Beniscar.
Fine, but where are the gold-stitched robes and the gaudy rings?
An aide entered behind them, coughed, and then said, Adjunct, three horses are saddled and waiting outside. Thank you. Suddenly Beniscar was chilled, his hands cold and stiff, as if he'd left them in buckets of ice water.
Adjunct, we do not know if the heart will be freed. If you...
They will succeed, Demidrek. Your own god clearly believes that.
Wrong.
She was startled to silence.
It's simpler than that, adjunct.
Beniscar went on, the words tasting of ashes.
Drek doesn't care if the crippled god is whole or not. If he's little more than a gibbering fool, or a gutted body with a huge hole in his chest, it doesn't matter. Whatever you have of him, she wants it gone.
Then, her eyes narrowed.
Correct. Listen to her last, Demidrek, because he knows when his god has lost all faith.
They won't fail,
Tavare whispered, eyes once more on the sword.
And if the perish betray them, what then?
But she was shaking her head.
You don't understand.
All are putative allies, adjunct. Are they strong enough, willful enough, stubborn enough? When the bodies start falling, when the blood starts flowing, listen to me, Tavare. We have to weigh what we do, all that we do here, on the likelihood of their failing.
I will not.
Do you think I have no respect for Prince Bryce Bedict or Queen Abrastal? But, adjunct, they are striking where Akrath Corvalane is at its strongest, where the most powerful of the Fokrul Asael will be found. Has it not once occurred to you that your allies won't be enough?
But she was shaking her head, and Beniscar felt a flash of fury.
Will you be nothing more than a child? Hands over your ears because you don't like hearing what I have to say?
You do not yet understand, Demidrek. Nor, it seems, does your god.
So tell me then. Explain it to me. How in Hood's name can you be so sure?
The Kachain,
adjunct, this is the last gasp of those damned lizards. It doesn't matter who seems to be commanding them either. The matron commands. The matron must command. If she sees too many of her children dying, she will withdraw. She has to, for the very survival of her kind.
They are led by Gessler and Stormy, Beniscar.
Gods below! Just how much faith have you placed in the efforts of two demoted marines?
She met his eyes unflinching. All that I need to. Now, you have indulged your moment of doubt, I trust. It is time to leave. He studied her for a moment longer, and then felt the tension draining from him, managed a lopsided smile.
I am Demidrek to the Worm of Autumn, adjunct. Perhaps she hears you through me. Perhaps in the end we can teach Drek a lesson in faith.
Better, she snapped, picking up the sword. They stepped outside. The three horses were waiting, two saddles as yet unfilled. Slouched in the third one, Banaskar looked up, nodded in greeting.
Captain?
Priest, Fiddler replied. He and the adjunct swiftly mounted up, the scrawny animals shifting beneath them, and then the three of them swung away, rode out from the Malazan encampment on the grassy plain, riding northwest. There had been few words on that journey. They rode through the night, alternating between canter and trot. The western horizon was lit on occasion with lurid lightning, the flashes stained red, but overhead the jade strangers commanded the night sky, bright enough to expunge the stars, and the rolling grasslands around them bore a hue of healthy green the day's light would reveal as false. There had been no rain in this place for years, and the hoofs of their horses kicked up broken blades of grass like scythes. When they came in sight of a lone rise that dominated all the others, the adjunct angled her horse towards it. The lesser hills they crossed as they drew closer all bore signs of ancient camps, boulders left in ragged rings to mark where the sides of teepees had been anchored down. 1,000 paces to the northwest, the land dropped down into a broad, shallow valley, and its far slope was marked by long, curving stretches of rocks and boulders, forming lines, blinds and runs for herd beasts now long gone, as vanished as the hunters who had preyed upon them. Banaskar could feel the desolation of this place, like an itch under his skin, a crawling unease of mortality.
It all passes. All our ways of doing things, seeing things, all these lost ways of living. And yet, could I step back into that age, could I stand unseen among these people, I would be no different inside. Gods, could I explain this even to myself, I might someday make a claim to wisdom. Our worlds are so small, they only feel endless because our minds can gather thousands of them all at once. But if we stop moving, if we hold to one place, if we draw breath and look around, each one is the same, barring a few details. Lost ages are neither more nor less profound than the one we live in right now. We think it's all some kind of forward momentum, endless leaving behind and reaching towards. But the truth is, wherever we find ourselves, with all its shiny gifts, we do little more than walk in circles. The thought makes me want to weep.
They drew rein at the base of the hill. The sides were uneven, with projections of rust-stained bedrock pushing up through the thin skin of earth, the stone cracked and fissured by untold centuries of frost and heat. Closer to the summit was a crowded chaos of yellow-white dolomite boulders, their softer surfaces pecked and carved with otherworldly scenes and geometric patterns. Spikewood and some kind of prairie rose bushes, skeletal now and threatening with thorns, filled the spaces between the boulders. The adjunct dismounted, drawing off her leather gloves.
Captain?
Aye, he replied. It will do.
When Fiddler slipped down from his horse, Banaskar followed suit. The adjunct in the lead, they ascended the hillside. Now closer to the rotted outcrops, Banaskar saw bleached fragments of human bone trapped in cracks and crevasses, or heaped on ledges and in niches. On the narrow, winding tracks between the upthrust bedrock, his boots crunched on beads made from polished nuts, and the ground was littered with the withered remnants of woven baskets. Reaching the summit, they saw that the dolomite boulders formed a rough ring, perhaps 10 paces across, with the center area more or less level. When the adjunct walked between two boulders and stepped into the clearing, her lead boot skidded and she lurched back, Righting herself, she looked down, and then crouched to pick something up. Banaskar reached her side. She was holding a spear point made from chipped flint, almost dagger length, and the priest now saw that the entire stretch of level ground was carpeted in thousands of similar spear points.
"Left here, all unbroken," muttered Banaskar as Fiddler joined them. "Why, I wonder?"
The captain grunted. "Never could figure out holy sites. Still, those tools are beautifully made. Even an Imas would be impressed."
"Here is my guess," Banaskar said. "They discovered the technology that was too successful. Ended up killing every animal they saw until none were left. Why? Because we are all equally stupid. Just as short-sighted, 20,000 years ago or tomorrow makes no difference. And the seduction of slaughter is like a fever. When they finally realized what they'd done, when they all began starving, they blamed their tools. And yet," he glanced across at Fiddler, "even to this day we think efficiency is a good thing."
Fiddler sighed. "I sometimes think we only invented war when we ran out of animals to kill." Dropping the spear point, it broke in half when it struck the lair of its kin. The adjunct stepped forward. Stone snapped with every stride. When she was at the very center, she turned to face them.
"This is not a matter of sacredness," she said. "There is nothing worth worshipping in this place, except perhaps a past that can never again exist. And the name for that is nostalgia. I'm not a believer in innocence, either."
"Then why here?"
Banaskar asked. But it was Fiddler who answered.
"Because it is defendable, priest."
"Demidrek?"
Tavare asked, one hand now on the grip of her sword. He looked round, stepped over to see one of the dolomite boulders. Swirling patterns, grooves flowing like hair. Demonic, vaguely human figures, faces composed of staring eyes and open mouths filled with sharp teeth. He sighed, looked back at the adjunct, and then nodded.
"She can, I don't know, wrap herself round the base of this hill, like a dragon worm of legend, I suppose."
"To what end, Demidrek?"
"Containment."
"For how long?"
"Until she dies."
He shrugged. He saw her studying him for a moment longer, and then the adjunct Tavare drew out her Ototaral sword. The rust-colored blade seemed to blaze in Banaskar's eyes, and he staggered back a step. Nearby, Fiddler swore under his breath.
"Adjunct, it's awake." "And," whispered Banaskar, "it shall summon."
Tavare kicked a space clear on the ground with one boot, and then set the sword's tip against the earth. She pushed down, using all of her weight. The blade slid, as if through sand, down to half its length. Stepping back, the adjunct seemed to reel. Banaskar and Fiddler reached her at the same time, taking her weight.
"Gods, there is so little left of her, bones and skin."
She slumped unconscious in their arms.
"Here," grunted Fiddler, "let's drag her back. Find somewhere clear."
"No," said Banaskar. "I will carry her down to the horses."
"Right, I'll go ahead. Get her some water."
Banaskar had picked Tavare up.
"Fiddler."
"Aye," he growled, "like a starved child under that armor. When she comes round, priest, we're making her eat."
The soldier might as well have said, "We're laying siege to the moon," and been absolutely convinced that he would do just that, and then take the damned thing down in ruin and flames.
"It's how a soldier thinks, at least this one, this damned marine."
Saying nothing, he followed Fiddler down the narrow, twisting track. She had been laid down on a threadbare saddle blanket. Banaskar had unstrapped and removed her helm, and rested her head on the worn saddle they'd pulled from the adjunct's horse. Off to one side, Fiddler was splintering wood and building a small fire. Taking a water skin, the priest soaked a bundle of bandages from the sapper's kit bag and began tenderly wiping the sweat and grime from Tavare's brow and those so plain features. With her eyes closed, He saw the child she had once been, serious, determined, impatient to grow up. But the face was gaunter than it should have been, too old, too worn down. He brushed tendrils of damp, lank hair from her forehead, then glanced over at Fiddler.
Is it just exhaustion, do you? Gods below, Fiddler!
The man was breaking up his deck of dragons, using his knife to split each card. He paused, looked across at the priest.
She's getting a cooked meal.
Banaskar watched as the sapper fed the splinters into the fire. The paints filled the flames with strange colors.
You don't expect to survive, do you?
Even if I do, I'm done with this, all of it.
You couldn't retire from soldiering even if you wanted to.
Really? Just watch me.
What will you do? Buy a farm? Start growing vegetables? Gods no. Too much work. Never could figure out soldiers saying they'd do that once they buried their swords. Earth grows what it wants to grow. Spending the rest of your life fighting it is just another damned war.
Right then. Get drunk. Tell old stories in some foul tavern.
Like you was doing back in Mala's city?
Banaskar's smile was wry.
I was about to advise against it, Captain. Maybe it sounds good from here, being able to live every moment without purpose, emptied of all pressure. But take it from me, you'd do just as well topping yourself. It's quicker and probably a lot less miserable.
Fiddler poured some water into a pot and then set it on the flames. He began dropping shreds of dried meat into it.
Nah, nothing so wasteful. Thought I'd take up fishing. Never figured you for a man of the seas.
You mean like in a boat with lines and nets? Out on the waves and o'er the deeps?
No, not that kind of fishing, priest. Sounds like work to me, and dangerous besides. No, I'll stay ashore. I'm thinking hobby, not livelihood.
Glancing down at Tavare's lined face, Banaskar sighed.
We should all live a life of hobbies, doing only what gives us pleasure, only what rewards us in secret, private ways.
Wise words, priest. You're just filled with surprises tonight, aren't you?
When Banaskar shot the man a look, he saw his faint grin and the tension eased out from him. He grunted.
I went into the priesthood looking for wisdom, and only then did I realize I'd gone in precisely the wrong direction.
Piety not all it's made out to be, then?
Is soldiering, Fiddler?
The man slowly settled back, stirring with his knife blade.
Had a friend once. Tried warning an eager little boy away from the soldier's life.
And did your friend succeed?
Doesn't matter if he did or didn't. That's not the point.
So what is the point, then?
You can't steer anyone away from the path they're going to take. You can show 'em that there's plenty of other paths. You can do that much. But past that, they'll go where they go.
Your friend should have scared that boy rigid. That might have worked.
Fiddler shook his head.
Can't feel someone else's terror either, Banaskar. We only know terror for what it is when it looks us dead in the eye.
There was a sigh from Tavare, and the priest looked down.
You fainted, adjunct. The sword, it's done.
She struggled to sit up.
Then we must leave.
We will, adjunct, Fiddler said. But first, we eat.
Tavare pushed Banaskar's hands away and struggled upright.
You damned fool! Do you know who that sword is summoning?
I just burned that card, as it happens.
Banaskar almost felt the adjunct's shock, like a jolt of sparks snapping through the air between them. The priest snorted.
You've gone and made her speechless, sapper.
Good. Can't eat and talk at the same time. Come over here, adjunct, else me and the priest will have to hold you and force this stew down your throat. Won't do any good if you go and collapse at the wrong moment, will it?
You should not have done that, Fiddler.
Relax, the man replied, tapping his satchel. Saved one house, the only one that means anything to us now. Ours is a house still divided, Captain.
The king in chains? Never mind him. The fool's too busy undermining the throne he happens to be sitting on. And the knight is with us.
Are you certain?
I am. Be at ease on that count.
When that god manifests, Fiddler, it will be upon the battlefield. Thousands of souls will feed its shaping. We are speaking of a god of war. When it comes, it could well fill half the sky.
Fiddler glanced across at Banaskar, and then he shrugged.
Beware the vow of a Toblakai.
And then, with a half-smile, he filled a tin bowl with stew and handed it up to the adjunct.
Eat, dear consort. The rest are with us. Reaver, Fool, the Seven, Leper.
And his gaze fell for a moment with that title, before he looked back up, grinned over at Banaskar.
Cripple. Cripple? Oh, well, yes. Been staring me in the face all this time, I suppose. Been thinking it was terror, that old mirror reflection. And surprise, it was.
While they ate, Banaskar's memories wandered back to the moment in her tent and her words with Lostara, and all that followed.
Children, gather close. Your mother's days are fraught now. She needs you. She needs us all.
Glancing up, he saw Tavare studying him. Banaskar, was it you who removed my helm, wiped down my face and combed through my hair? His gaze dropped.
Yes, adjunct.
She made an odd sound and then said, I am sorry. I must have looked a mess.
Oh, Tavare.
Fiddler rose suddenly and said in a gruff voice,
I'll saddle your horse, adjunct.
Hedge watched as the three riders rode back into the camp.
A verdict. Distribute the munitions.
The alchemist turned and in a startled voice asked,
All of them?
All of them. And get them kitted out. Water, a little food, armor and weapons and nothing else.
I'll go talk to the sergeants.
Nodding, Hedge set off. He found Fiddler on foot just outside the adjunct's tent. The man was alone, standing looking down at the ground.
We're coming with you,
Hedge said. Fiddler looked up, scowled.
No, you're not. The bridge burners are coming with you. Nothing you can do about it.
It's all over with, Hedge. Just leave it alone. And he turned away. But Hedge reached out, pulled the man round.
I already asked the adjunct. I did it last night, once I figured out what was going on. You need me there, Fiddler. You just don't know it yet. You don't know the half of it. But you'll just have to trust me on this. You need me there.
Fiddler stepped close, his face dark. Why? Why the fuck do I? Passing soldiers paused, turned to stare.
You just do. If you don't, I swear this, Fid, I swear it, you'll spend the rest of your days poisoned with regret. Listen to me. It's not only us, can't you see that? You need the bridge burners.
Fiddler pushed him back with both hands, staggering Hedge.
They're not bridge burners. It's not just a fucking name. You can't just pick up any old useless fools and call them bridge burners. Why not?
Hedge retorted.
It's what we were, wasn't it, at the beginning? Young and wide-eyed, stupid, and wanting to be better than we were.
He waved an arm to take in the camp.
No different from these bone hunters. Don't you see that? Don't follow me. You're not listening. I went through, I came back. I have no choice, damn you.
There were tears glistening in Fiddler's eyes.
Just don't.
Hedge shook his head.
I told you, no choice, none at all.
When Fiddler pushed past him, Hedge let him go. He looked round, scowled.
It's almost noon. Go eat something, you slack-jawed bastards.
Then he headed back for his company's camp. Fiddler cut between two staff tents and made it halfway down before he stopped and slowly sank to one knee, his hands over his face. As tears broke loose, shudders drove through him, wave upon wave.
We're going to die. Can't he see that? I can't lose him again. I just can't.
He could still feel Hedges' shoulders where he'd pushed him and see the hurt look on the man's face.
No, don't.
His hands stung. His hands burned. He balled them into fists, head hanging, forcing himself to draw deep breaths, forcing all the rawness away, and with it the terrible anguish that threatened to break him, crush him down. He needed to go to his soldiers now. The sergeants would have them ready, waiting, Marines and heavies, the last of both.
One more thing to do, and then we'll be done. All of it, finished. God's Hedge, we should have died in the tunnels. So much easier, so much quicker. No time to grieve, no time for the scars to get so thick it's almost impossible to feel anything at all. And then you showed up and tore them all open again. Whiskey Jack, Callum, Trotz, they're gone. Why didn't you stay there with them? Why couldn't you just have waited for me?
Still the tears streamed down his face, soaking his beard. He could barely see the matted dead grasses beneath him.
End this. One more thing to do. They'll try and stop us. They have to. We need to be ready for them. I need to be a captain, the one in charge, the one to tell my soldiers where to die.
Wiping at his face, he slowly straightened.
Gods, he muttered. First the adjunct, and now this.
He sighed.
Let's just call it a bad day and be done with it. Ready, Fid? Ready for them? You'd better be.
He set out. There was glory in pissing, Korab decided, as he watched the stream curve out and make that familiar but unique sound as it hit the ground.
Doesn't look like you need both hands for that,
Smiles observed from where she sat nearby.
Today I shall even look upon you with sympathy, he replied, finishing up and then spitting on his hands to clean them. Sympathy? What am I, a lame dog?
Sitting leaning against his pack, Bottle laughed, earning a dark look from Smiles.
We are going somewhere to fight, Korab said, turning to face her and the others sitting on the ground beyond. Today, you are all my family.
Explains the sympathy, Korik muttered.
And I will stand at your side, Korik of the Seti, Korab said.
Smiles snorted.
To what? Keep him from running? No. Because this time he will stand with us. He will be a soldier again.
There was a long moment of silence from the gathered squad, and then Korik rose and walked a short distance away.
There's demons crouched in his brain, Cuttle said under his breath. All that whispering must be driving him mad.
Here comes the sergeant, Korab said. It's time.
He went to his kit bag, checked the straps once again, picking up the crossbow and admiring it for a moment before tying it on to the satchel. He recounted the quarrels and was satisfied to find that they still numbered 12.
Load up, Tar said when he arrived. We're headed northwest. That's damn near back the way we came, said Smiles. How far? If I even come within sight of that desert, I'll slit my own throat. It's a big lake now, Smiles, Bottle pointed out.
Tar said,
should be there by noon tomorrow, or so the captain says. Take food for 2 days and as much water as you can carry.
Korab scratched at the beard covering his jaw.
Sergeant, the regulars are getting ready to break camp too.
They're going east, Corporal.
When do we rendezvous?
But the sergeant's only reply was a sharp glance, and then he went to his own gear. Smiles edged up close to Korab.
Should have used that thing for more than just pissing, Corporal, and now it's too late.
Oh, I get it. We're not coming back.
Then we march to glory.
Hood's breath,
Smiles sighed. But he caught a look on her face, quickly hidden.
She is afraid. She is so young. And you, Smiles, shall stand on my other side.
Did she almost sag towards him then? He could not be sure, and she kept her face down, turned away as she worked on her satchel.
You have let your hair grow long, he said. It makes you almost pretty.
Cuttle edged close.
You really don't know when to keep your mouth shut, do you, Korab?
Form up, Tar said. We're in the lead to start. Cuttle met his sergeant's eyes and gave a faint nod. Tar turned and looked ahead to where Fiddler waited. The captain looked ill, but he held Tar's gaze without expression, and then Fiddler swung round and set off. Their march would take them through the entire camp of regulars, down the central, widest avenue between the uneven rows of tents, awnings, and blinds. The sapper looked up at the sky, then back down again. Those blazing slashes seemed closer than ever, unnerving him. Cuttle waved the others in their squad forward, then glanced back to see Balm leading his own soldiers, and beyond them Sergeant Erb, and then the rest of them, Pelion, Badan Gruk, Sinter, Gauntai, and the heavies falling in wherever they felt like it. He stepped in behind Shortnose. The man had a way of wandering off, as if forgetting which squad he'd joined, but now he was here, trudging along under a massive bundle of rolled chain armor, weapons, and shield. The heavy had tied a Naruk finger bone to his beard, and it made a thumping sound on his chest as he walked. His maimed shield hand was bound up in leather straps. As they walked, the regulars to either side began converging ahead, as if to line their route, as if to watch in that hood-damned silence of theirs as the marines and heavies passed. His unease deepened.
Not a word from them, not a thing, as if we're strangers.
As the troop approached the broad avenue, the only sound came from their marching, the hard impact of their boots and the clatter of equipment. And through his growing anger, Cuttle had an uncanny sensation of walking through an army of ghosts as the regulars drew up on either side. He didn't see a single youthful face among all the onlookers.
And not a nod, not even a tilt of a head. But we look just as old and ruined, don't we? What are they seeing? What are they thinking? Tavaray, I don't envy you, these soldiers. I can't read 'em at all. Do they understand? Have they worked it out yet? They're heading east to block the army the Asael are sending after us, to buy us the time we need. But if they can't do it, if they can't slow the bastards down, it's all lost. This whole damned thing falls apart. You're headed for a fight, and we won't be there for you, any of you. No fist of heavies, no knots of marines in the line. So if that's a look of betrayal in your faces, if you think all this is about abandoning all of you, then hood take me.
The thought ended abruptly, and Cuttle's growing anger simply disintegrated. The regulars began saluting, fists to their chests, standing at attention in suddenly perfect rows to either side. The few muttered conversations among the marines and heavies fell off, and suddenly the silence became oppressive in an entirely different way. Cuttle felt more than heard the company's footfalls slipping into cadence, and in the squad directly in front of him he now saw the soldiers edging into paired rows behind Captain Fiddler, with Korab and Tar in the lead, Smiles and Korik behind them, followed by Bottle and Shortnose.
You just had to be uneven, growled Balm in a low voice as he came up on his right. Then drop back and shake this out all over again. Can't even remember the last time I found myself on a parade. No, we just hold this sapper and hope to hood no one trips over their own hood-damned feet. Wasn't expecting this. I hate it. I feel sick. Where are we going again? Stop panicking, Sergeant. And who in the White Jackal's name are you, soldier?
Cuttle sighed.
Just march, Sergeant. Once we get through this, we can relax again. Promise. We getting medals or something? No, this is something else. This is what the adjunct said wouldn't happen. Look at these regulars. They're witnessing us.
Did you see this?
Kisware asked. Sinter kept staring straight ahead, but she frowned.
What do you mean? Your visions. Did you see any of this? And what about what's coming? What about tomorrow or the next day?
It's not like that.
Her sister sighed.
Funny. I can see what's coming. right through to the very end.
No, you can't. That's just fear talking. And it's got a lot to say. Just leave it, Kisswear.
No, I won't. Tell me about a vision of the future, with us in it.
Here's mine. You've got a baby on your hip, with a boy running ahead. It's the morning walk down to the Imperial School, the one they were building before we left. And I got a girl who looks just like me, but wild, a demon in disguise. We're exhausted in the way of all mothers, and I'm getting fat. We brag about the runts, complain about our husbands, bitch at how tired we are. It's hot, the flies are out, and the air smells of rotted vegetables. Husbands. When are they going to finish fixing the roof? That's what we want to know. When instead of doing something useful, the lazy bastards spend all day lying in the shade picking their noses. And then if that's not...
Stop it, Kisswear.
To Cinta's astonishment, her sister fell silent.
Was that the first time? Must have been. Sorido, the miller's boy. I'd woken up that morning with tits. We went behind the old custom house annex, on that burnt stubble where they'd toasted an infestation of spiders only a few days before, and I lifted up my shirt and showed them off. What was that boy's name? Rilt? Rallet? His eyes got huge. I'd stolen a flask from the house. Peach brandy. You could set your breath on fire with that stuff. I figured he needed loosening up. Good knows I did. So we drank and he played with them. I had to fight him to get his cock out. And that was the first time. Wish there'd been 1,000 more, but it didn't work out that way. He was killed a year later in his father's shop. Some rushed order on ship fittings. Rumours of another crackdown on Cartuli pirates because the Malazan overlords were losing revenues or something. They weren't pirates. That's just a name for people being obvious about theft. There could have been other boys, dozens of them. But who wants to lie down on the ground on an island crawling with deadly spiders? Rallet or Ralt or whatever your name was, I'm glad we fucked before you died. I'm glad you had at least that. It's not fair how the years just vanish.
I love you, Helion. How hard could it be to just say those words? But even thinking them made Herb's jaw tighten as if bound in wire. Sudden sweat under his armour, a thudding heart, a sickening sensation of nausea in his throat. She had never looked better. No, she was beautiful. Why wasn't he the drunk? Then he could blather out all he wanted to say in that shameless way drunks had. But why would she want him then, unless she was just as drunk? But she wasn't anything like that now. Her eyes were clear, and they never rested, as if she was finally seeing things, and all that slackness was gone from her face, and she could probably have any man she wanted now, so why bother looking at him? He kept his gaze ahead, trying not to notice all these regular soldiers with their salutes. Better to pretend they weren't even there, weren't paying them any attention, and they could walk out of this army, off to do whatever it was that needed doing, and no one needed to notice anything. Attention made him nervous, when the only attention he really wanted was from her. But if she gave it to him, he'd probably fall to pieces.
I'd like to make love, just once, before I die. I'd like to hold her in my arms and feel as if the world's just slid and shifted into its proper shape, making everything perfect. And I could see all of that right there in her eyes. And looking up, I'd see all these soldiers saluting me. No, that's not right. Don't look up, Herb. Listen to yourself, idiot.
Widdershins found that he was walking beside Throatslitter. He'd not expected an actual military march, and already his bare feet inside his worn boots were raw. He'd always hated having to throw his heels down with every step, feeling the shocks shooting up his spine, and having to lift his knees higher than usual was wearing him out. He could see the end ahead, the edge of the damned camp. Once out of sight of these wretched regulars going all formal on them, they could relax again. He'd happily forgotten all this shit,
those first months of training before he'd managed to slip across into the Marines, where discipline didn't mean striding in cadence and throwing the shoulders back and all that rubbish, where it meant doing your job and not wasting time on anything else. He remembered the first officers he'd encountered bitching about companies like the Bridge Burners.
Sloppy, slouching slackers. Couldn't get them to stand in a straight line if their lives depended on it, and as likely to slit their officers' throats as take an order.
Well, not quite. If it was a good order, a smart order, they'd step up smart. If it was a stupid order, an order that would see soldiers die for no good reason, well, the choice was not doing it and getting hammered for insubordination or quietly arranging a tragic battlefield casualty. Maybe the Bridge Burners had been the worst of the lot, but they'd also been the best, too. No, Widdershins liked being a Marine, a bone hunter in the tradition of their unruly predecessors. At least it had put an end to this kind of marching. His heels were already bloody in his boots. Dead Smell didn't want to say goodbye, not to anyone. Not even Throat Slitter limping one row ahead of him, whom, with a choice comment or two, he could make yelp that laugh, like squeezing a duck. Always entertaining, seeing people flinch on hearing it, and Dead Smell could do it over and over again. It had been a while since he'd last heard it, but now was not the time, not with all these regulars on either side, all these men and women saying goodbye to us. The Bone Hunters were in their last days. This tortured army could finally see the end of things, and it seemed to have come up on them fast, unexpected, appallingly close.
But no, we marched across half a world. We chased a whirlwind. We walked out of a burning city. We stood against our own in Malaz City. We took down the Lethary Empire, held off the Naruk. We crossed a desert that couldn't be crossed. Now I know how the Bridge Burners must have felt as the last of them was torn down, crushed underfoot, all that history vanishing, soaking red into the earth. Back home in the Empire, we're already lost. Just one more army struck off the ledgers. And this is how things pass, how things simply go away. We've gone and marched ourselves off the edge of the world. I don't want to say goodbye, and I want to hear Throat Slitter's manic laugh. I want to hear it again and again, and forevermore.
Hedge had drawn up his Bridge Burners just outside the northwest edge of the encampment. Waiting for the Marines and heavies to appear, he scanned his collection of soldiers. They were loaded down, almost groaning beneath the weight of their gear.
Way too many kittens.
Sergeant Rumjugs caught his eye and he nodded. She moved up to position herself at his side as he turned to face the Bone Hunter camp.
Ever seen the like, sir? Who do you think gave the command for that? Maybe the adjunct herself?
Hedge shook his head.
No command, Sergeant. This came from somewhere else, from the regulars themselves, rank and file and all that. I admit it, I didn't think they had this in them.
Sir, we heard rumours about the Marines and heavies that maybe they won't want us with them.
Doesn't matter, Sergeant. When it comes right down to it, we don't even take orders from the adjunct.
But didn't she...
I lied, Hedge said. I ain't talked to nobody. This is my decision.
He glanced over at her.
Got a problem with that, Sergeant?
But she was grinning. Hedge studied her.
You find that funny, do you? Why?
She shrugged.
Sir, we heard rumours, other ones, about us not being real Bridge Burners. But you just proved them wrong, didn't you? We don't belong to nobody, only to each other and to you, sir. You lied, ha!
Behind them, Sweetlard said,
Last night I took a man to bed for free, sir, and you know why? When he asked me how old I was, and I said 26, he believed me. Lies are sweet, ain't they?
Here they come, said Hedge.
Fiddler had appeared, leading his troops out from the camp. Even from this distance, Hedge could see the faces of the Marines and heavies, sickly, grim. They'd not been expecting any sort of send-off.
And they don't know what to do with it. Did Fiddler throw a salute back?
No, he wouldn't have. Fid, I see you. You're as bad off as the rest of them, like you're headed for the executioner. Us soldiers only got one kind of coin worth anything, and it's called respect. And we hoard it, we hide it away, and there ain't nobody who'd call us generous. Easy spenders were not. But there's something feels even worse than having to give up a coin. It's when somebody steps up and tosses one back at us. We get antsy, we look away, and part of us feels like breaking inside. And we get down on ourselves, and outsiders don't understand that. They think we should smile and wave or stand proud. But we don't want to do anything of the sort, even when we're made to. It's because of all the friends we left behind on all those battlefields, because we know that they're the ones deserving of all that respect. We could sit on a king's hoard of those coins and still stay blind to all of them. Because some riches stick in the throat and choke us going down. When he saw Fiddler look up and see him, Hedge strode over.
Don't do this, Fid.
Do what? I told you, not that. You halt your company now. You form them up facing those regulars. You're captain now, and they're looking to you. It's the coin, Fiddler. You got to give it back.
The captain stared at Hedge for a long moment.
Didn't think it'd be this hard. So you thought to just run away?
Fiddler shook his head.
No, I didn't know what to do. Wasn't sure what they wanted.
Cocking his head, Hedge said,
You're not convinced they're worth it, are you?
The captain was silent. Hedge shook his head.
We ain't made for this, you and me, Fid. We're sappers. When I get in trouble on all this stuff, I just think, what would Whiskey Jack do? Listen, you need those regulars to stand up. You need them to buy you the time needed. You need them to buy it with their own blood, their own lives. It don't matter if you think they've not earned a damn thing. You got to give the coin back.
When Fiddler still hesitated, Hedge swung round and gestured to his bridge burners, then turned back.
We're forming up, Fid, faces to the camp. You just gonna stand there with all your marines and heavies mobbing up and not knowing where to fucking look?
No,
Fiddler replied in a thick voice.
Hedge, I think I just faltered a step, that's all. Better now than a few days from now, eh?
As Hedge moved to join his squads, Fiddler called out,
Wait!
He turned back.
What now?
Something else everyone needs to see, I think.
And Fiddler stepped forward and held out his hand. Hedge eyed it.
You think that's enough? Start there, idiot.
Smiling, Hedge grasped that forearm, and Fiddler pulled him into a hard embrace. Badal stood atop a wagon, Sadik at her side, watching the scene at the edge of camp.
What's happening, Badal?
Sadik asked.
Wounds take time to heal,
she replied, watching the two men embracing, feeling a vast tension seem to drain away on all sides.
Are they lovers? Brothers,
she said.
The one with the red beard. You called him father, Badal. Why? It's what being a soldier is all about. That is what I have seen since we found them. You do not choose your family, and sometimes there's trouble in that family, but you don't choose. But they did. They chose to be soldiers. And then they come face to face with death, Sadik. That is the blood tie. And it makes a knot not even dying can cut. And that is why the others are saluting. Soon, she said, very soon, we are going to see this family awaken to anger. But Mother is sending those ones away. Will we ever see them again? It's easy, Sadik, she said. Just close your eyes.
Walking slowly, Pors made his way to the edge of the camp so that he could look out on the marines and heavies, who were now forming up to face the regulars. He looked round for the adjunct but could not see her, nor was Fist Blistig anywhere in sight.
The man who tried to murder me.
There is nothing more dangerous than a man without a sense of humour.
As Fiddler and Hedge drew apart and headed for their respective companies, Faradan Sort came up alongside Paws, and then, on his other side, Fist kindly. Paws sighed.
"Fists, was all this by your command?"
"I was barking orders when they just stood up and left me standing there," said Faradan Sort. "They're as bad as Marines, these regulars."
"We will see if that's true soon enough," kindly said. "Master Sergeant Lieutenant Paws, are you recovered?" "Some additional healing proved possible once we were away from the desert. As you see, sir, I'm up and about." "It is your innate laziness that still needs addressing."
"Yes, sir."
"Are you agreeing with me, Master Sergeant Lieutenant Paws?"
"I always agree with you, sir." "Oh, enough, you two," Faradan Sort said. "We're about to be saluted."
All the regulars had drawn to this side of the camp and stood in an uneven mass. There was an ease to all of this that Paws found peculiar, as if the entire structure of the military, in all its rigidity and inane affectation, had ceased to be relevant. The regulars no longer held their own salute, and now stood watching, for all the world like a crowd drawn down to the docks to see a fleet's departure from the bay, while Captain Fiddler moved out to stand in front of his marines, facing them all. He lifted his hand in a salute, held it for a moment, as his soldiers did the same, and then let the hand fall. And that was it. No answering gesture from the regulars. Paws grunted.
"It's the old coin thing, isn't it?"
"Indeed," replied kindly in a rough voice.
He cleared his throat and said,
"That tradition was born on the Seti Plain from the endless internecine warfare among the horse clans. Honest scraps ended in an exchange of trophy coins."
He was silent for a few breaths, and then he sighed.
"Seti combs are works of art, antler and horn polished to a luster. I feel another bout of laziness coming on, sir. Isn't it time you ordered me to do something?"
Blinking kindly faced Paws, then shocked him with a hand on his shoulder.
"Not today."
And he walked back into camp. Faradan Sort remained at his side for a moment longer.
"If he had a son to choose, Paws..."
"I've already been disowned once, Fist, and regardless of what you might think, I'm not a glutton for punishment."
She studied him.
"He was saying goodbye."
"I know what it was,"
Paws snapped, wincing as he turned too quickly away. When she reached to take his arm, he waved her off. Both gestures made his chest hurt, but that was the kind of pain he welcomed these days, keeping the other kind at bay.
"Forgot to thank him. Dead smell. And now it's too late. And now kindly goes all soft on me. Where's the fun in that?"
"Go back to your wagon," Faradan Sort said. "I'll detail 3 squads for the harness.
No heavies now."
"Better make it 4, Fist."
"It is my understanding," she replied, "that we do not have far to go today."
Despite himself, he glanced over at her.
"Really? Has she announced our destination then?"
"She has."
"And?"
She looked across at him.
"We're looking for a suitable field of battle."
Paws thought about that for a few moments.
"So they know we're here?"
"Yes, Lieutenant. And they are marching to meet us."
He looked to the departing column of Marines and heavies.
"Then, where are they going? This is what I get for lying half dead for days, and then spoon-feeding old Shorthand, waiting for a word from him. Just one word, something more than just staring into space. That's not a proper way for a man to end his days. And now I don't know what the hood's going on. Me, of all people."
The camp was breaking up behind him. Everything coming down for the march was barely a single word spoken. He'd never known an army as quiet as this one.
"Fist?"
"Yes."
"Will they fight?"
She stepped close, her eyes cold as ice.
"You don't ask that kind of question, Paws. Not another word, am I understood?"
"Aye, Fist. I just don't want to be the only one unsheathing my sword, that's all."
"You're in no condition for that."
"That detail hardly matters, Fist."
Making a face, she turned away.
"I suppose not."
Paws watched her head back into the camp.
"Besides,
I might need that sword. If Blistig gets close, it's not like he'll be of any use in the scrap. The very opposite, in fact. But I'll choose the perfect moment. It's all down to timing. All of life is down to timing. And that was always my talent, wasn't it? I'm mostly a nice guy. Made a career of avoiding blood and fighting and all the unpleasant stuff. The challenge was pulling that off while being in an army. But not as hard as it sounds. No matter. It's not as if I'm afraid of war. It's the chaos I don't like. Kindly's combs. Now, you see, those I do understand. That man I understand, through and through, and being his one unruly comb, why, how perfect was that? Mostly a nice guy, like I said, but Blistig tried killing me for a few empty casks. I don't feel like being nice anymore.
Adjunct wishes to see you, Fist, said Lostara Yil.
Blistig glanced up, saw the look in her eyes and decided to ignore it. Grunting, he straightened from where he had been sitting amidst discarded equipment. He followed the woman through the camp, paying little attention to the preparations going on around them. These regulars were good at going through all the motions. They'd done enough of it, after all, and had probably walked more leagues since forming up than most people did in a lifetime. But that didn't add any notches on the scabbard, did it? For all their professionalism, suddenly rediscovered since the blood for water miracle, and not just rediscovered but reinvented with a discipline so zealous it bordered on the obsessive, these regulars looked fragile to Blistig. They would melt away before the enemy at the first hint of pressure. He'd seen them lining the route taken by the marines and heavies. He'd seen their pathetic salutes. Good for gestures now, these soldiers, but their faces were empty. They had the look of the dead, every man, every woman. When Lostara reached the entrance to the adjunct's tent, she halted, gesturing him inside. He moved past her, stepped within. Only the front chamber remained standing. The back end of the tent was already unstaked and hanging in a thick, creased wall behind Tavaray, who stood facing him. There was no one else present, not even that smirking priest, and Lostara Yil had not followed him in.
"What is it, adjunct? I have troops to oversee if you want us up and on the way before noon."
"Fist Blistig, I am placing you in command of the center. You will have Fist Kindly on your right and Fist Faradan Sort on your left. War leader Gaul will hold the Cundrill in reserve, along with the skirmishers and archers." He stared at her, dumbfounded.
"You are describing the presentation for battle," he said. "But there won't be any battle. It will be a rout. We will face Forkrell Asael, and you've gone and given up your sword. Their sorcery will overwhelm us."
Her eyes held on his, unwavering. "You will hold the center, Fist. That is your only task in the upcoming engagement. You will be attacked by normal soldiers, Colansi, a conventional army. Expect them to be highly disciplined and well-trained. If there are heavy infantry among the enemy, then you can be certain that they will strike for your position. You will not yield a single step, is that understood?" Blistig drew off his helmet, contemplated throwing it at the woman standing opposite him. Instead, he clawed a hand through his thinning hair.
"I could kill her right now here in this tent. But she bought their souls again, didn't she? I'd never get away alive. Better to wait, find a more perfect moment. But then who am I trying to fool? Put me there, adjunct, and I'll take a knife to the back before the Colansi even crest the horizon."
There was a look in her eyes that made him wonder if she'd seen right through to his thoughts. If she knew how close she was to being murdered and simply did not care enough to feel fear. "Fist, I was advised when in Arran to leave you in command of the city garrison. Indeed, there was talk of promoting you to the city's Fist. And had that occurred, it is possible that you would then be touted to become High Fist, overseeing all of South Seven Cities. I understand that what I have just described would have suited you perfectly. At least until the next uprising." Blistig's voice was a rasp.
"What is the point of this, adjunct?"
"However, your proponents, the officers and functionaries in Arran,
couldn't see a span beyond their city's walls. They could not imagine that Jistal Malik Rel would not rot away the rest of his days in a jail cell or lose his head to a pike above the main gate. In other words, they had no comprehension of the extent of the man's influence, how it had already corrupted the Claw, or that his agents were even then positioned within reach of Lassine's throne. Furthermore, she continued, still studying him, that his hatred for you and your betrayal at Arran following Coltane's fall pretty much assured your eventual assassination. You may indeed be unaware that between the fall and my arrival in the city, 3 attempts were made on your life, all of them successfully intercepted, at the cost of 4 valuable agents. Your transfer to under my command was in fact the only means of keeping you alive, Fist Blistig. The 4th time your life was saved was at Malaz City. Had we failed in extricating ourselves, you would have been arrested and executed. Now, you may choose to believe that I undertook such efforts because I value you as a commander, and be sure that to this day I remain impressed and admiring of your quick wit and decisiveness when refusing to yield Arran to the rebels. But that was not my primary reason for saving your life. Malik Rel, High Fist Corbalo Dom, and their interests would seek to revise the events at Arran. The outlawing and castigation of the Wiccans was but the beginning. Fist Blistig, there are few who know the truth of those events. I saved your life to keep that truth alive. He was silent following this speech. A part of him wanted to disbelieve every word, wanted to call her a damned liar and a self-serving one at that. But how could any of this be self-serving? She was placing him in command of the center, probably facing heavy infantry among Malazan soldiers who despised him. She'd saved his life only to throw it away now. And how did that make sense, any sense at all?
Adjunct, are you expecting me to thank you?
The only expectation of any importance, Fist, concerns commanding the center to the best of your abilities.
They won't follow me.
They will.
Why should they?
Because they will have no one else.
No one. Where will you be, Adjunct?
I will be facing the Fokral Asael and their sorcery. I will be fighting the power of their will. I will be preventing it from reaching my soldiers.
But you gave up your damned sword, woman!
There are residual effects to bearing such a weapon, Fist. In any case, none of that is your concern.
Except when you fail, when you fall.
Even then, Fist. His eyes narrowed on her.
That only works if you take them down with you. Is that the plan, Adjunct? One final sacrifice to defend an army that doesn't even like you, that doesn't want to be here, that doesn't even know what it's supposed to be fighting for? And then you expect me and the other Fists to hold them together, with you dead and gone?
She cocked her head. You are contradicting yourself. He waved a dismissive hand, the gesture chopping the air. Tavare seemed to flinch slightly at that, but the tone of her next words belied the impression. Maintain your line with the flanks, Fist.
We're going to get cut to pieces.
Turning away, she reached for her leather gloves. If so, Fist, just make sure you take a long time dying. He left without bothering to salute, walked with his helm dangling from one hand.
3 foiled attempts on my life? A corrupted Claw? Then who did the foiling?
Banaskar stood 20 paces away from her tent, motionless while figures moved in measured haste around him, wanting to be a heavy stone in the stream, a place to set a foot and find an instant or two of rest. But his was a lifeless island until Lostara Yil found him, taking his arm in hers and pulling him round. Hanar Vigolf grinning off to one side.
What is this?
Banaskar demanded, only vaguely resisting as she led him away. He'd just seen Blistig exit Tavare's tent, his stride echoing that of a lifeless Talani Mas, and he'd been considering going to the adjunct again to see what he could glean of what had taken place between her and the Fist. Instead, he was being pulled away. and there, ahead, stood a small group of officers, Scannero, Ruthen Gud, Raband, and Faradan Sort. Banaskar sought to disengage his arm.
You keep forgetting I'm not actually in this army.
Our last palaver, said Lostara. Make it mocking, make it solemn, however you like it, priest, but it will happen, and you will be in attendance.
Why?
They'd reached the others, and Banaskar saw the expectation in their faces and wanted to hide under a shield. Ruthen Gud, fingers combing his beard, was the first to speak.
Priest, we've all been given our orders. Will you be at the adjunct's side through all of this?
All of what? The dying?
I don't know. I doubt it.
Why?
Asked Faradan Sort, the word sharp, accusing. He shrugged.
I expect she will be fighting, eventually.
Lostara Yil cleared her throat in the silence that followed and then said,
She has ordered me, Hanar and Ruthen Gud, to attend to her at all times.
That makes sense, Banaskar said.
It's the Forkrel Asael, isn't it?
To Lostara's question, Banaskar simply shrugged again.
She has surrendered her sword somewhere, said Faradan Sort. How does she expect to defend herself against the sorcery of the Asael?
I don't know.
Raband voiced a raw curse and looked ready to leave, but Scannero shook her head at him and he subsided, scowling. Lostara caught Banaskar's eye. He could see fear in hers.
Priest, I do not think I will again shadow dance. Not the way I did before. If she is expecting such a thing from me, perhaps against the Forkrel Asael.
Captain, I don't know what she is expecting, said Banaskar quietly. You and Ruthen Gud, you have both shown exceptional abilities. Is that why she wants you close? I imagine that it is. And at the moment of greatest need, will she look to you too? Why wouldn't she?
I can't do it again.
Banaskar glanced over at Ruthen Gud.
And what of you, Captain? Besieged by the same uncertainties, are you? Or will the gift of the Storm Riders reawaken to protect you?
The adjunct clearly believes that it will, he replied.
Have you told her otherwise, Captain?
It's complicated.
Is it not why you're here? Banaskar asked. Was this not the reason for their gift?
The others were studying Ruthen Gud now, and the man looked decidedly unhappy.
It depends. Nobody's ever as forthcoming on these things as one might like. Did they know what was hidden in Kollantz? Probably. Are they interested in liberation?
Hardly,
growled Faradan Sort, one hand now on the sword belted at her side. Ruthen Gud's eyes flicked down to that weapon, and his smile was wry when he lifted his gaze to Faradan's.
I suspected you had a sound reason for forswearing the wall.
I fought 3 links from Greymane.
Ruthen Gud nodded but said nothing more. Breath hissed from Lostara Yil.
This isn't fair. Ruthen, do you fear using what the Stormriders gave you?
The Stormriders are not a people given to compromise,
Banaskar said, when it was clear that Ruthen Gud had no intention of replying.
The captain senses the ambivalence in what is to come, and the risk of failure. He anticipates that the power of the Storm Riders will, if unleashed, conclude that said risk is too great, with too much to lose should the adjunct's plan fail.
Lostara said,
Ruthen, do you not control that power?
Finally, the man scowled and said,
Ask that of yourself and the Shadow Dance, Lostara Yil.
But that is the will of a god.
And whom do the Storm Riders serve? Does anyone even know? You, Faradan? Are they mindless, senseless creatures? You have stood the wall. Tell her. Tell her what you have seen with your own eyes.
They have purpose, she said slowly. They are driven. More than that, I cannot say. This is getting us nowhere, said Raband. The fact is this, you and me, Scannero, we're in command of our companies. Is there anything more that you and I need know?
Then I suggest we head back to our troops and leave the rest of their discussion to our superiors.
Banaskar watched him dragging Scannero away by one arm. She threw a look back at Ruthengard, but he either did not notice or chose not to, and so did not see the crushing grief take her face. Sighing, Faradan Sort drew her gauntlets from her belt.
Fare you well, captains.
The priest looked up at the morning sky, squinted at the jade strangers.
Never been closer. We only have a day or two. Not more, surely.
Cotillion swore to me that he would never again take possession, said Lostari Yil.
Banaskar shot her a searching look.
Too tempting, I imagine.
What's given and what's taken away, priest?
He nodded, understanding her meaning.
I was expecting to survive all of this, said Ruthengard. Now I am not so sure.
So you know how the rest of us feel, snapped Lostari Yil.
But the man simply turned to Banaskar.
If you will not be with her, priest, then where will you be? What is your reason for being here?
There is a question that has been haunting me,
he replied over the sound of the first horns announcing column formation.
How does a mortal win over a god? Has it ever happened before, even? Has the old order been overturned? Or is this just special circumstance? A moment unique in all of history?
You have won the Worm of Autumn to her cause, priest?
At Lostara's question, Banaskar frowned. He studied her for a moment and then glanced at Ruthengard.
You look shocked, he said to him. Is it that I somehow possessed that power? Or is it the very idea that what we do in this mortal world, with our lives, with our will, could make a god kneel before us?
Then he shook his head.
But you both misunderstood me. I was not speaking of myself at all. I cannot win over a god, even when I am the last priest in that god's house. Don't you understand? It's her. She did it, not me.
She spoke to your god?
Banaskar grunted.
No, Lostara. She rarely speaks at all. You of all people should know that by now. No. Instead, she simply refused to waver from her path, and by that alone she has humbled the gods. Do you understand me? Humbled them!
Ruthengard shook his head.
The gods are too arrogant to ever be humbled.
A year ago, lying drunk on my cot, I would have agreed with you, Captain. So tell me now, will you fight for her?
His eyes were thinned as he studied Banaskar, and then he said,
with all my heart.
The gasp that came from Lostara was almost a sob.